My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock. And I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical... But I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know. And then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hey everybody, welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me in the studio today is Mr. Karim Alzand, who is a Canadian-American composer, he is also a professor at Rice University's Sheppard School of Music, and he is one of the artistic directors of Musica, which is an ensemble here in town.
Yeah, it's a group of composers who sort of put on concerts of brand new music.
Aha, yeah. Karim, we're super happy to have you here today because we've been trying to get you in here forever, and now we've got you trapped.
Mm-hmm. Can't escape.
What are we going to talk about today?
So I thought I would talk about something that's really interesting for me, which is this particular kind of piece. It's usually piano pieces, but it's not always, which I like to call pattern preludes. And I'm not sure I invented that term, but it's certainly not a common term. Sometimes they're called figural preludes. But basically, it's this kind of piece where you have a certain sort of texture that goes all the way through the piece. But it fascinates me because it's a really interesting window into compositional process, which as a composer, I'm interested in, and to see how composers make music, and you can sort of get a window into what they're thinking. Pattern preludes are... they're almost visual in a certain way. You can sort of look at the page. Even if you don't read music, you can kind of look at the page and sort of see what the music might sound like in a certain way. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should play one, and you'll get an idea from this. This first example is what I think of as sort of the most foundational pattern prelude. I mean, it's a piece that a lot of people know, but it's also kind of the purest example of what I mean by a pattern prelude. Mm-hmm. And it's this piece by Bach. It's a prelude in C major, and it's the first piece in his large group of preludes and fugues called the Well-Tempered Clavier. And this was written around 1722 or so. And well-tempered clavier just means, clavier just means keyboard. Well-tempered, a bit of a long story behind that, but I'll sidestep it. Basically, it has to do with how the instrument is tuned. And if something is well-tempered, it's tuned in such a way that you can play in any key and it'll sound good.
Ah, okay. Thank you for explaining that. I've heard of this for ages, and I always thought it was just sort of a weird name.
Mm-hmm.
Like he was sort of anthropomorphizing the instrument.
Right. It's the well-behaved piano.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. No, well-tempered is just, it turns out there are a lot of different ways. You know, we have a kind of standard tuning that we use now, but in the 17th and 18th century, there were a lot of different ways of tuning an instrument, a keyboard instrument in particular. And depending on how you tuned it, you could get some keys that would sound really nice and other keys that would sound really terrible. So a well-tempered keyboard is a keyboard in which you can play in any key and it'll sound pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
So anyway, yeah. So this is a group of pieces, 48 pieces that he wrote in every key. And this is the first one, the one I'm going to play is the first one. It's in C major. So it's his opening piece in this really, really long epic project that he's going on. So let me play it and you'll see what I mean by pattern prelude.
Okay.
Thank you. So that's Bach's C major prelude. Do you notice anything about sort of the way it sounds?
Yeah, it goes up and down and up and down and up and down. And it's sort of like, I'm looking at this sheet that you've given me where I'm looking at this piece by Chopin and this piece by Bach. And the notes, I mean, they look like little hills. It seems like, and I see that the Chopin piece is actually called an exercise. So mm-hmm. It seems like Bach is sort of just kind of seeing what the piano can do.
And I don't know if you noticed it, but basically it sort of repeats the same gesture again and again and again and again and again. I mean, essentially the whole piece is kind of one little thing that gets spun out.
Yeah. Yeah. Bach was kind of into that, I've noticed, from what little I know of him. He likes, he kind of liked to take things and play them backwards and then play them inside out.
Yeah, there's a certain kind of intellectual kind of cerebral aspect to some of the music, which is true. I think the neat thing about this piece is that you can sort of think of it in two dimensions in a way. So what I mean is there's sort of the surface of the music that's actually happening and sounding that's very animated. So that's this kind of, you know, that's happening right on the surface. But then if you almost remove that from the equation, you could think of the piece as being really this. And that simply the surface is animating that. So that turns into, and that turns into.
So he's basically like deconstructing power chords.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the neat thing about it is that if you look at the manuscript for this piece, at the beginning, and I think that's on that sheet that I gave you, but at the beginning, he writes it out normally like you'd expect it to be written out with all the notes there. And then about a third of the way through, he gets a little lazy. And he stops writing. You know, so you hear this twice. And rather than writing out all of those notes, you know, writing out all of those 16 notes, he just writes. And then about a third after that, he gets even lazier. And he doesn't even write out two of them. He just writes out.
Yeah? He just expects for you, the pianist, to
You figure it out, right? Because it's the same every measure, right? It's the same every measure. He just gives you, these are the notes. And you churn it through the little animated pattern that he's created for you. And he doesn't need to write it out every time. You just kind of go with it.
So I know that Bach was he was a teacher, and that he wrote like the Bach inventions and things like that. For example, as like teaching tools. Was this another teaching tool?
Yeah, this piece in particular, a lot of the keyboard works actually were not published during his lifetime, and they were used by him as teaching tools for his kids primarily.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Because he had like, 20
lots.
Kids or
he
something?
He had a lot of kids. Yeah.
Like he really did. He had something like 12 kids.
Yeah. And an amazing number of them went on to become musicians, composers, quite well-known composers. Like there's C.P.E. Bach and there's W.F. Bach and J.C. Bach. There's a lot of them.
Well, and all of these things are just, they seem so foundational. Like he's sort of just, you know, he's, like I said before, he's kind of seeing what the piano can do. And so it must have been neat as one of his kids to kind of, you know, get that sort of ground up look at music.
Yeah.
And to kind of get to know it that way.
And the other thing is that these kind of pieces are almost an invitation to composition in a certain way. Because you could imagine, well, if you could use this same series of verticalities, the same series of chords, one after another, but you could invent a different figuration, right? A different pattern on top of it. So instead of doing, you could do it. You know, a little bit different, right? Mm-hmm. And you could totally change the character of the piece, but use the exact same harmony.
Yeah.
So that's why I think they're really interesting pieces from a compositional perspective.
Yeah.
The other neat thing about it is if you can imagine yourself as a composer, right, writing a piece like this, you'd want a really strong series of harmonies going through, right? Because that's kind of what's driving the whole piece, because nothing else is changing, right? Everything else is the same.
Yeah.
And you'd want to be able to design a figuration that's interesting enough to hear it, you know, 100 times.
Right.
Right? Because you're hearing it twice every measure, you know, from the beginning to the end of the piece. It basically never changes.
Okay, so that brings up my next question about this, which is, He's one of the, you know, very first classical composers, and you know, he kind of set the stage for others. But then I'm looking at this Chopin, and I'm wondering why Chopin would continue, you know, in his time much later to do this kind of thing. Like,
yeah, I mean, Bach is one of these kind of foundational composers that a lot of composers look to,
yeah.
You know? And Chopin in particular, especially being a composer for the keyboard,
mm-hmm.
revered Bach. And he was also a teacher. And he used Bach's music in his own teaching. And in fact, the well-tempered clavier, this piece I've talked about, was sort of the one piece that he would take with him wherever he went. If he had to take one piece of music with him when he was traveling, he would take the Bach well-tempered clavier. So he really knew Bach's music very, very well. And, you know, just to move into talking a little bit about Chopin, I mean, the piece that I brought in is one of his earliest pieces. It's a series of etudes, which is a French word, just means studies, Opus 10, and the first one is in C major, same key as the Bach. And in fact, there's even more connections to the Bach. If you listen to the C major, it's a very different character in terms of the piece. It's quite fiery and flashy and virtuosic. But from the point of view of the texture, it's a pattern prelude.
Mm-hmm.
And it uses a very, very similar progression to the Bach in the opening. Maybe listen to it and see if you can hear any of that.
Okay. Sounds like Liberace.
It's very, very virtuosic. But can you tell that he's using the same pattern over and over again? He goes up to the top of the keyboard and then comes all the way back down and then does the whole thing over again.
Yeah. You know, that always really fascinates me about just creativity in general. How, say, a writer comes along and their jumping off point is their idol, the person that got them wanting to write to begin with. But then they take what that person has done and they take it another step or three or whatever. And then the next person comes along, and that's you can hear that in this Chopin.
You definitely can. And I mean, there are a lot of things that are innovative about this Chopin piece. I mean, for one thing, it sort of ushered in a whole new era of technical piano playing. I mean, it's very difficult to play. You notice I chose not to play it. It's very difficult to play, and the leaping that it does up and down the keyboard was actually something quite new, at least in the way that Chopin does it here. And whereas the Bach also does this leaping, it's much more modest leaping, you know?
Uh-huh.
It's maybe skipping instead
of
leaping.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting that way. Incidentally, this kind of motion is called an arpeggio. I don't know if you know that word.
I have heard that word, but I've never.
Yeah, arpeggio is kind of an Italian word which comes from actually the same word for the harp, to play it on the harp. And you know, if you know the harp, a lot of music on the harp is played in this fashion where they play one note after another going up, and then one note after another going down. You know, this sort of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So an arpeggio is when music does that, it kind of leaps from one note to another note in this way. So both of these pieces, the Chopin and the Bach, feature arpeggiation all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Are these pieces that students of piano and other instruments play regularly as like exercises? Are these played live? Like, how are these used?
Well, I think both of these are played live, although the Chopin is notoriously difficult to play, and so a lot of people will not play it live for that reason. It's very tricky to manage to play very, you know, cleanly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the Bach, less so, obviously. But yeah, these are pretty important pieces. So you will, you would definitely hear them in concert, although I think it was Vladimir Horowitz famously refused to play the Chopin C major in public.
Just really?
Because it was so difficult. Yeah.
Well, you and I were talking about playing in the key of C major before we started recording, and you were talking about why it's so hard to play in that key. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. It has to do with how your hand is shaped. And if you just kind of hold your hand up in front of your face, you realize that the fingers are not all parallel to one another.
And
not
if they
all
are,
the same
you
line.
Are a
if
mutant.
If they are, you should see somebody. Yes. So you know that your first and second finger are higher than your third and fourth finger, and your thumb is in a different place entirely. And if you think of the piano keyboard, C major means playing all the white notes.
Yeah.
And the white notes are all perfectly parallel to one another at the bottom part of the keyboard. So if you think of shaping your hand to play all of those white notes, you kind of have to shift it a little bit. It's a little bit awkward to do. So C major, for that reason, is actually a little bit awkward of a key, even though it's simple in the sense visually you can see all the notes. It's harder to play from a physical standpoint.
Yeah, you have to sort of cramp your fingers up into a claw,
exactly.
I'm sure. So we've got Bach, we've got Chopin. Like what comes after that in this?
Well, there are a couple of other examples. A lot of composers who write for the piano use this method, this idea of coming up with a series of harmonies and then an animated surface and just sort of continuing all the way through. Here's a neat piece, very short piece by Schumann, which does the same thing. And you can hear totally different character, but the process is exactly the same.
And on the classical music timeline, Schumann comes after Chopin?
Yes. They're about the same time.
Okay,
so we're not going too far
in the
future, really.
But this is Schumann's take on this.
Yeah, and Schumann is a very different composer than Chopin. You'll get the sense of his character, at least in this piece.
Okay.
Very short piece, huh?
It's really cool.
It's very cute. Yeah, it's called Elfe, which means like elf or fairy or some sort of a fantastical creature.
Some sort of wood nymph type
of
creature. It's neat, these exercises or this thing. Tell me what it's called again.
Pattern prelude.
So it's like this thing where you can see the different composers' take on it, and you can really get a taste for the differences between their styles
definitely.
Just by looking at this one type of thing.
Exactly. And I want to try a little experiment on you. Are you up for an experiment?
Yeah, totally.
Okay. Well, I mean, to me as a composer, as someone who kind of works creatively on it, the first thing I wanted to do is I wanted to kind of mix and match some of these pieces, right? Because you have a pattern and then you have a harmony. Well, what would happen if you took Chopin's harmony and put it into Bach's pattern, right? Or took Bach's pattern and used Chopin's harmony for it,
sure,
right? So you could kind of get these really interesting amalgams.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what the Chopin harmony sounds like. You know, it's going along at 100 miles an hour, so it's hard to kind of hear it. But here's the harmony if I were to slow it down, and maybe we can contrast this with the actual real-time music. But here's what it sounds like in a kind of chordal form. Okay, and compare that to the real music. So hopefully there you could hear I was just sort of playing the harmonies in the background while all the fireworks were happening in the piano.
Yeah.
So now I'm going to take that harmony, okay, and I'm going to put it into Bach's pattern. You remember Bach's pattern?
Sure.
What's interesting about the Chopin harmony, it begins and ends on the same point, just like the Bach does. So the Bach goes... Yeah, it kind of has this circular quality. It begins where it ends. And so does the Chopin. It's a little bit longer. It's a little bit more... you know, complicated maybe harmonically, but it begins and ends in the same spot. So here's now what Bach's pattern sounds like with Chopin's harmony filtered through it.
Okay. That's cool.
You hear that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. And then, of course, I thought, well, I wonder if you could do the opposite. Could you take Bach's harmony and put it into Chopin's pattern?
Yeah.
So I wrote that out, and of course, I got one of my students to play it because it's too hard for me to play. But I have a recording of that. You can hear, now, again, you're going to hear Bach's harmony, right? So the more modest harmony of Bach, but now in this fiery version that goes up and down the piano.
Okay. I like that.
Could you hear that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a more toned down version of the Chopin. It's
right.
kind of, you know, a little backwards looking. But yeah, so, you know, you can perform these kind of interesting experiments about, you know, what does Chopin's harmony sound like in Bach's surface texture?
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about contemporary work, since you're a contemporary music guy? Like, that kind of work these patterns into them and...
Yeah, there are a lot of pieces that do this. I would say the big kind of music that does it is minimalist music. I don't know if you've had anyone come talk to you about that.
I've learned a little bit about Steve Reich and a little bit about John Cage.
Right, and so this kind of music definitely uses patterns, for sure, right? Uh-huh. I mean, it's sort of the point of the whole music is to use these patterns. Where it's different from the Bach is that in that music, usually the patterns gradually change over time.
Mm-hmm.
They change little by little, and sort of the gradual change of the pattern is kind of what marks the interest in the music, whereas the harmony is likely to change a little bit less often. So it's again, a different take, but on the same kind of principle.
Yeah, okay. So the minimalists were basically taking this and putting it through, as I see here on this Bach piece, a harmonic reduction.
There you go, harmonic reduction.
That's
you've learned a new term.
I love this. It's the well-tempered clavier, so we've got this behaved piano.
Uh-huh.
And then we're putting it through a harmonic reduction, and then we're going to put it over noodles.
It sounds like we're making some
kind
of sauce.
Cooking show.
Yeah. I've been fascinated with these pieces for a while. And of course, you know, the way that composers deal with these sorts of obsessions is to kind of write music. So I have written a whole series of pieces, which I call pattern preludes, you won't be surprised to know, where I try to do all kinds of different variations on this this basic principle in different ways. They're all piano pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought maybe I'd play at least one for you to get an idea of kind of what's going on in these pieces. The first one is interesting, and I'm not going to tell you anything about it. I'm just going to play it for you, and I want to see what your reaction is and if you can hear anything in it.
Okay.
Sound familiar at all?
It sounds like, so you've got one hand doing the same sort of up and down. The other hand is sort of skipping around within that pattern.
Yeah.
Sort of lazily, like.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Almost like it's sort of doing its own thing without any regard for what the other hand is doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the other hand, one hand is very regular like the Bach,
uh-huh.
and the other one is a little bit more floating.
Yeah.
Know? Yeah. So this is the first one of the pattern preludes, and I figured it was only right that the first one would be based on the Bach.
Uh-huh.
So essentially what I've done is I have the Bach being played by the left hand, because mm-hmm. it's simple enough that you can actually play it with one hand. You don't need two hands to play it.
Yeah.
If you're really good.
Yeah.
And you can play that with one hand, and then I have the right hand do sort of superimpose something on top of it. And I think what's neat about this piece, I'm going to teach you another word.
Okay.
So, you know, we talked about the pattern. And if you count how many notes are in this pattern?
I'm going to guess 5.
I'll do it super slow. Yeah, 5. And actually, some of them are repeated. Right?
Uh-huh.
So I'll do it slow. That's 5, right?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then what does Bach do? 3, 4, 5. He repeats 3, 4, and 5 again.
Uh-huh.
So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah?
Yeah.
So one thing about this pattern is that the basic pulse, the basic motion of the music is essentially binary. It's duple. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, right? Or you could count it in fours if you wanted to, but it's basically binary, right? Mm-hmm. But if you think about the pattern, I'm going to play it in a kind of a strange way, and you would never actually perform it this way, but see what you make of this. What am I doing there?
You're sort of emphasizing the one note. You're changing the rhythm a little bit?
I'm not really changing the rhythm, but I'm changing the groupings.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Right? Yeah. So it's always steady, that, 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 that. But if you accent certain notes, like I'll do another one. I'm kind of accenting different groupings within the pattern. Uh-huh. And those groupings actually are groups of three. Uh-huh. So I'll do it. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
Yeah? The name for that is hemiola.
What?
Hemiola. Add it to your vocabulary list.
It sounds like some kind of boil or something.
It sounds
like
a,
oh, I've got a hemiola.
That's right. You need to have it removed immediately. Hemiola. So hemiola is when you take a pattern of three, which we just saw, right? Uh-huh. A pattern of three, and you sort of superimpose it in a way on a pattern that's basically binary.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what, you know, I talked earlier about when you're writing a pattern in a pattern prelude, you've got to write a pattern that's interesting enough to hear it many, 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 many times. Mm-hmm. And that's why Bach's pattern is interesting, because it's got this kind of built-in, doesn't have like kind of a little bit of a kind of funky feel to it? Is that like syncopation? Yeah. Have you heard that word before?
I've heard that.
Yeah, syncopation. Yeah. So it's like going against what the basic pulse of the music is, and it gives a kind of lilt to mm-hmm. it, you know? And so in my piece, I took advantage of this idea that there's this hemiola, three mm-hmm. against two, happening in the piece. And I put the part that I added in the right hand all using threes.
Yeah.
So it kind of feels like it's in a different orbit, you know, a little different orbit, because it's using all the hemiolas that are already in the Bach, but that I kind of extrapolate and sort of uh-huh. play out.
It's crazy to me that, okay, so we started with this really simple Bach, and now you as a contemporary guy have like taken it to this totally different place, which I'm sure he never envisioned, but like I don't know, there's just something really neat about that it's still like today, you know, what, 300 mm-hmm. something years later, it's still something that you can take apart and rearrange in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think for a lot of composers, Bach really looms pretty large in their their imagination and in their terms of their influence, and it's because the music has such depth, and even when it's seems simple.
Yeah.
There's actually a lot in there. And, mm-hmm. you know, the more you look into it, the more things you find. And that's kind of what's interesting about music that I think composers really like, is that it's has a kind of surface elegance and simplicity and inevitability about it. But then when you look at it and you study it from a kind of compositional standpoint, you discover all of these intricacies that maybe, you know, that make it sound so simple in a certain way.
Yeah. Well, I liked that you used the word inevitability, because that's how, you know, genius usually seems when you first see it. It seems obvious, yet no one has ever done it before. It seems like it was right there for the taking. And Bach but he took it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then he did something with
it. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely part of it. And then the other side of the same coin is that there's an awful lot of craft that goes into this too, uh-huh. you know? And I think that also appeals to composers too, because it's genius, it's sort of inspired, but in the same way you can sort of see all the decisions that went in, all the craft that went into making it when you look at it.
So these are great pieces for people who are kind of new to classical music to kind of get a feel for different composers. This is what I have learned from this experience.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's true. And, you know, there are a lot of composers that use to varying degrees, mm-hmm. this kind of technique. And sometimes, you know, the great thing about the Bach example is it's so pure, you know,
yeah.
from the beginning to end. Other composers will use it with more or less purity, you know, sort of use this idea of a pattern prelude, but the pattern might change here or there, or you know what I mean? So it may be not a kind of textbook example,
yeah.
but the idea, I think, is still there.
Can you give like a quick list of like 5 composers that maybe listeners could go check out and like listen to these specific sorts of pieces to get a feel for them?
Sure. I mean, I think essentially any composer that writes for the keyboard. So let's go. Actually, we can even go backwards from Bach because Bach didn't invent this. It seems like this piece is, you know, the Ur piece for pattern preludes. But
yeah.
actually, there are other composers before Bach that used it, like François Couperin, who's uh-huh. a French composer. Sort of a contemporary of Bach, a little bit older actually, and he's written a lot of his pieces have this kind of mold.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's Bach, of course. There's Chopin. There's Schumann. Brahms will do this occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of different examples. Scriabin, mm-hmm. another example of a kind of much later sort of turn of the century composer that you can look to. So yeah, you'll find it almost everywhere you look, in one way or another. Some composers are more predisposed to doing this sort of thing than others, but
cool. All right, listeners, you have your homework assignment. Go out and listen to all of those composers that he just named doing this kind of stuff. Karim, thank you so much for coming in.
You're very welcome.
Being on the Classical Classroom.
It was fun.
It didn't even hurt. You,
no.
You did it, and
it was painless.
Like relatively.
And I even had a hemiola.
You even had a hemiola. This is really cool. I'm gonna go check out some of the composers that you just named and get a feel for the different styles and times.
Great.
All right, that about does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. As some of you may have noticed, we've got some things going on in the digital world. Our mothership, Houston Public Media, has a new website, and therefore all of the Classical Classroom stuff is kind of under construction. We're all wearing hard hats. We look like the village people. But in the end, it's going to be great. We actually have a brand new SoundCloud page that's all our own. Go to soundcloud.com/classicalclassroom. You can find all of our shows there. You can, of course, still find us on iTunes. And if you are on SoundCloud, follow us on iTunes. Rate us. It's just the nice thing to do, people. Thanks to our audio producer, Todd Holslander, to our program director, Sinjin Flynn, for his always spot-on spiritual guidance, to me for saying words, and to our guest, Karim Elzan, for being so awesome and coming in and taking his time to do the show today. Thanks to you for listening, and we'll catch you next time.